leaders. What keeps you up at night? Welcome to The Sweet Spot, the podcast series that expands the traditional term of what a boss is to tackle some of the most important issues in business. From business as usual and growing your market to everyday leadership issues or handling one in 100 year events, we aim to provide ongoing inspiration and education for CEOs, founders, management, shareholders, and leaders of every stripe. The Sweet Spot is the future of work and business.
David Fiscus is the founder, president, and CEO of Xanafin Strategies, a highly focused communication and sustainability firm that practices in crisis communication, public affairs, public relations, and ESG and sustainability. Fiscus is one of the nation's leading crisis communication experts and has worked on major national and international crises for almost 30 years. In 2021, an all-journalist jury for the Best in Biz Awards selected him as the Crisis Executive of the Year. Please welcome David.
David Fiscus, welcome. You were named Crisis Executive of the Year by the Biz Awards last year, I think it was.
For 2020, yeah.
Yeah. Was it for your work on the pandemic? I think it's presidential campaign issues, aviation, justice issues and culture. What a huge achievement.
It was kind of a surprise. But I guess if you hang around long enough and you do enough work and you work with enough journalists, they get to know you. And this award was it's awarded by journalists.
So. Yeah.
And I think it was for a combination of things. We did an awful lot of work in the pandemic, both PR work and consulting work with various companies like Caesars Entertainment, a huge, Las Vegas based gaming company, about 81,000 employees.
And,
we worked with them. We hired on three epidemiologists at the beginning of the pandemic. So when consulting with companies and what they were communicating, what they were doing, we had the expert medical advice. So they were making decisions based on science, not just kind of making things up. It was that we had some very high profile things that I worked on in the kind of the Me Too movement in the,
yes,
in the United States, little natural disaster work,
just a couple
airplane
of
crashes.
Yeah. Wow.
Some high profile litigation.
And David, did you do this from home or a combination of work and home? How did you handle it and how are things now?
Well, so we were fully remote, like most people for a long time, from the beginning of March in 2020 until June of 21, when we came back to the office. Went remote again when kind of Omicron Prime started striding across the planet. But our workforce has changed pretty, dramatically. We've got a hybrid model now. One of my key people has been with me for 12 or 13 years, lived in Washington. She wanted to move back to Tennessee, where she's from. She said, "What do you think of that?" I said, "Well, a year ago, I probably wouldn't have been very open to it, but now knock yourself out."
I guess things what we do is quite measurable, right? So you're either creating results for clients and they're happy or they're not. So I think from that point of view is you've got a trust relationship, and as long as the results flow, then yes, you can live wherever you like, right?
I think with public relations overall, it's exactly as you said, that it's result oriented. And, some people might be worried that their employees are going to be slacking off at home and, watching the latest, soap opera. But to achieve results, that's really not possible. And so remote working works quite well. I think it works quite well for everybody except for younger people, people at the beginning of their career or just a few years into their career, because they're missing out on the everyday casual, mentorship, that you get in an office setting. And they're especially, missing out on developing, you know, their network of people and bonding with their peers. They don't get that. It doesn't matter so much to me, you know, I'm in my late 50s and I did, you know, I've got a, you know, a Rolodex, right? Electronic Rolodex, which is, you know, hundreds of people at it, you know, I've done all of that and seen people, but for younger people, it's a, you know, I think it, it really can be, you know, detrimental. And I'll just give you one quick example is that I was sitting at my desk this morning working on something, and a young woman who's 24 years old, she's got a couple of years in the industry, came in and she said, I'm having a problem, you know, quick question, but how would you deal with this? I said, oh, I've dealt with that before. Why don't you try this? Entire exchange took less than 60 seconds, right? And when you're working remotely, you're not going to hit dial on Teams or Zoom or whatever to ask a 60-second question, right? And those type of things are cumulative. And so I think I think it's still important for especially for younger folks to be in the office.
So that's on the staff side, but on the client side, what we've noticed as well is it's almost made the 24/7 availability even more present, because you know you've got clients all over the world, and it used to be in the old days that you had to get on the plane and do the whole dog and pony show and present and do this and do that. But now it's Zooming every day, with, be it in China or US or Australia.
The demands, the time demands have gone up, certainly with the pandemic. So last evening I left my office at about the 11:30 at night, which is not, that time of day is not particularly you know, it's not an everyday event. You know, I have a life as well. But I had a call. I was working on a project with a client in Uzbekistan in Central Asia. And we started a call at 10 o'clock my time, which was 7 o'clock their time, slightly inconvenient for both of us. And we worked through it. And just by happenstance, when I was on the way home, right, I was talking to a potential client, right, in Germany. And, you know, it was quite early for them, right? But they really needed to talk. And I told them I can talk at like 11:30 or 12. It's about 6 a.m., 5:30, 6 a.m. there. So you're right. I mean, it's it's the globalization and working is just it's much easier for everybody, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah. And David, you know, with economic upheaval, the specter of world war, you know, what are boards worried about? I mean, how they, you know, on your side of the fence, you know, what are the top three things that boards are worried about in terms of running their businesses?
Well, I think that, that it's changed over the last, you know, couple of years. At the beginning of the pandemic, it was just uncertainty. Nobody knew how the, I mean, how is remote working? You know, how are we going to deal with customers? How are we going to deal with revenue? And I think that with a lot of companies, as they moved through the pandemic and they saw that their businesses didn't, you know, evaporate, that they still had revenue, that their organizations were you know, were adaptable. I think there's an awful lot of focus now by boards and, you know, C-suite managers is in the new world that we're living in, and it is a new world that we can compare very easily to the old world because it was just yesterday. How do we expand and how do we go out? How do we grow our business? How do we optimize our workforce? Because remember, you know, a lot of companies here in the U.S. at least, people didn't go back full time from going remotely in March, right? Until very recently, to late February, early March of this year. So they were all out for two years. We have one client, which is a holding company for a lot of media properties in the United States. They have 34 different media properties, and we've been working with them throughout, advising them with our physicians, with our epidemiologists on the things that they should do, because they've got to implement different things in different companies. You know, when you get Condé Nast, you know, magazine, which is one of their properties, you know, guess what? You still have to print that. You need printers, right? On this. And so there's been a lot of struggle with kind of figuring that all out. And now that people are generally back in almost all places full time, and you know, there's reticence on the part of a lot of older managers about, well, what do you mean it's not going back to the way it was before? What's up with this younger generation here that, that values the remote work? And so people are figuring that out. And I think that boards, at least the smart boards, are engaged with those with their companies on those those issues, and are helping their companies figure it out.
I think it's also about scaling the businesses, but ethically as well. I mean, in the 80s, these things that we're about to discuss would have been called the soft issues. But, you know, talking about sustainability, talking about team culture, talking about making sure that when you grow, it's not hurting the planet, that you're being accessible to all people across the spectrum. You know, I mean, you've introduced the ESG monitor and your Xenophone sustainability practice. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, we've been, we started out 22 years ago as a pure crisis communications firm when I founded the company, that mainly because I had been working in the airline industry and worked on a lot of crashes. And so I knew something about crisis, and you know, we've expanded since then. And crisis is still a big part of our business. It's about 30% of our business, you know, year in and year out. But as the PR has grown and has changed from just being earned media to being many things, is that we've expanded into areas that aren't traditional PR to help clients with things, to communicate things. Our ESG and environmental, social, and governance work for corporations is more straight consulting, is going in and helping companies, you know, figure that out, how to do that. And the differentiator for us in the marketplace is that once they're doing those programs and doing them in a real way, we have the communications expertise to put the overlay on that to let the world know what you're doing. And that's a very powerful, you know, combination when we get hired by companies. And you're really getting to the point, Duane, where even those corporations that used to kind of still thought of these as soft issues and poo-pooed them and, well, you know, we'll get to that at some point, now we're faced with the stark realities that, A, you can see climate change, you know, on TV. You can watch every summer California burn, or, you know, those terrible, you know, fires that did so much damage in Australia at the beginning of 2020. Remember, that's how 2020 started out. It started out with Australia burning, and it went downhill from there.
Right? Exactly. I know. So is there some sort of a report card or that boards can put together? You know, how do we measure these things while actually growing our businesses as well?
Well, when you look at sustainability, so ESG, you know, the three components of environmental, social, and governance, environmental gets the most attention. A lot of people think that ESG just means, you know, it just means environmental. But the corporations, the companies that are doing it correctly, are those that go in and engage in a real stakeholder process. You know, the first thing you go in is you look at issues through a materiality analysis. And this is the universe of issues that we need to focus on. Mm-hmm. And then to do it correctly, there's a stakeholder engagement process. And you know, stakeholders means, yeah, it means your employees, it means your customers, it means your investors, the suppliers, the people that you work with. Is you go out and you work with them on a stakeholder analysis, and you put the two of those things together, right? You take the issues you've identified, the stakeholder analysis, and you kind of put them through a sieve. And out of that, you get a priority list of things that you should be, you know, that you should be prioritizing. You know, you take just the S part of it, right? So the social part of it. We've got a client we're working with now, and you know, having gone through the materiality analysis and the stakeholder analysis, is guess what? Gender pay is a big issue for them, right? They need to. But how do they know to focus on that without doing the hard work that identifies it? And I picked the gender equality and pay because it's an easy issue. Yeah. A lot of issues are much more subtle.
Yeah.
And how do you know what your carbon footprint is as a corporation or as a country, unless you measure it, right? You've got to go in. If you're going to mitigate your carbon footprint, right, and do the things that you need to do, you got to know what it is first.
Yeah. And you speak about planetary issues. I mean, we have a lot of infrastructure, which is vital to the running of the planet, you know, transportation, environment, and, you know, energy corporations. Yeah. How do those people operate and still have a social license? Because, you know, we've seen evidence of big problems when the new energy is taken on too fast, you know?
Well, there is. So let me just give you two examples from the areas that we have worked in for many, many years. You know, the first is commercial aviation. Commercial aviation environmentally is, it's a unique industry because aircraft inject, you know, greenhouse gases and carbon high in the atmosphere. No one else does that, right? And that has its own set of problems that are there. And it goes without saying how important commercial aviation is to world commerce. Without being able to fly places and be able to move, it's one of the key underpinnings of our international, you know, economies. So how do you kind of reconcile those two things? So the industry manufacturers have made great stride in making more fuel efficient, emissions reduced, engines. And I will say, just as a caveat here, for full disclosure, we're Airbus's PR firm in North America and have been for 22 years.
Yeah.
Go Airbus. Not that Boeings aren't perfectly good planes, but,
yeah,
you know, because they are. Although Airbus doesn't make engines on things, but you get very innovative programs that are going out. So Airbus is a people think of it as they make airplanes. It's really a major technology company, and they're making major investments now into using hydrogen as a fuel and the next generation of aircraft that will be hydrogen powered. Hydrogen has no emissions.
Mm.
And so people are making those investments.
Yeah.
You know, the other one is the energy industry, is the utility industry, right?
Yeah.
Which I know we don't know an awful lot about. We have been the communications for an outfit called Mid-Continent ISO in the United States. And what they do is they run the transmission grid for electricity in about a third of the United States, right? They're the component of utilities that gets the power there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've seen more renewable come online, especially over the last 5 or 6 years. But in the U.S., if you look at any one time, 25 to 35% of electricity in the U.S. is coal generated, burning coal.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Is there anything worse than coal? No, there's not. It's not good, even mm-hmm. with modern technology that can scrub sulfur and things out of it. But What's the alternative? Are you going to turn off the lights, right? I mean,
exactly.
You know, no one wanted to invest in nuclear since the 70s. Nice, clean nuclear, you know. but you know, we're the industry's grappling with things.
Speaking of infrastructure and space and whatever, did you see the Elon Musk SpaceX? I think it was a documentary on Netflix.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know,
back to space. On Netflix.
Yeah, that's just.
I just returned from vacation last Sunday,
yeah,
and I watched it on the airplane home.
It's interesting in never giving up, I suppose. Like him or hate him, he's a very interesting guy, isn't he?
Absolutely. You know, fascinating to watch him, the things he goes for, accomplishes, and fascinating also to look at from a communications point of view, you know, for professionals like you and I, you know, it sometimes you know, you want to say like, you know, like, hello, Elon. Yeah, it's David. You need to shut the hell up. And you're not doing yourself any favors. You need to shut the hell up. Yeah. And you need to have somebody take a look at your tweets before you send them.
Yeah,
and,
exactly. We've got a little company here called Rocket Lab, which is a New Zealand space company. And they're the little company that could, right? So they are a competitor to Elon Musk's SpaceX. And they've successfully gone into the States, which is very, very... it's not very, you know, often that you can successfully go into the States from New Zealand. I mean, what are the rules of engagement in coming into the States from, say, Australasia?
You mean the trade rules or the governmental rules?
The perception is amongst startups in New Zealand is that, you know, America's the land of opportunity, but there's a lot of red tape. And it's a very, very difficult market to crack for Australasian companies.
I really wouldn't agree with that, right? And kind of based on my experience, we work a lot in Europe,
yes,
which is a much more heavily regulated place than the United States. And sometimes I'll be talking to, a few weeks ago, I was talking to a colleague of mine in Frankfurt, somebody we work very closely with. He says he was having to fire an employee that wasn't working out, and he was running me through what everything he had to do to do that.
Yeah.
And he says, well, what do you have to do in the United States? I'm like, you tell him to leave. Like, like you fire him, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a little more complex than that because there are protected classes of people if you're a minority or other things.
Yeah.
But here's the thing about the U.S. Market that you know, kind of gets brought up fairly frequently talking to people from outside the U.S. is this: it's the United States. It's the behemoth. It is the largest economy in the history of the world, and it can be very, you know, intimidating. You've got an economy that's throwing off things like Apple and Google or non-tech of Walmart can be very, you know, intimidating. But here's the thing about it. It is a huge economy with a lot of opportunity, I would just encourage people to not be kind of intimidated by it until you kind of look at it. And, you know, there is a perception, I think maybe what you're referring to, there is a perception out there that it's difficult to do business here. And that comes from one place and one place only, which is the state of California, right? It is difficult to do business in California with all the things we're about. We had an office in California, in San Francisco for about 11 years. And I finally shut it down and move people back to Washington just because I was so sick of dealing with the state government with all the stuff that they have. The most difficult places in the United States to do business are on the West Coast. It's Washington State, where Seattle is. It's Oregon, which is, they kind of live in their own world there. California.
Yeah.
And, you know, California is an enormous market. If California was a country, it'd be one of the top 10, you know, economies in the world.
Exactly. Speaking of governance and coming back to boards, often a board will sit around and there's an issue brewing, but it's not yet a crisis. You know, it's not yet a thing. What is your experience about the red flags that they should be looking at in terms of how early to get in on finding some solutions?
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up, because about 2 weeks ago we were engaged by a company, privately held but large company, does business in 12 or 14, you know, countries that are out there, about what they thought was going to be an issue that was going to break in the news from a disgruntled senior employee, very worried about it. And the first thing I told them is, you need to be prepared to engage, right? And prepared to engage now that this isn't just breaking now on top of us. Sometimes you don't have any time. We've got time. We need to prepare. And as much as I've counseled them, it's, you know, everybody wanted to take the stone out of the jewelry case and just to look it around and admire it and talk about it. And maybe we don't need to do this. Or what if we're doing these preparation things and our employees find out about it? And I've been telling for 2 weeks, it's, you need to move. And the moral of this story is what the boards need to do is they need to favor action, right? And favor action at the beginning level, step one on that is being prepared to take action, right? They're not the same thing, right? Yeah. As you well know, Duane, you're much better able to handle the quiet crisis if you are prepared. Any level of preparation for handling a crisis is better than no preparation. Yeah. You're always going to do better. And so favoring action initially means get in there and do preparation work. Mm-hmm. And if you know something's coming, that means start messaging and talking about it and, you know, analyzing, you know, media channels to see where risk can come in, where you may have an opportunity. And if it's not an issue, just in general, planning out there is do planning, do training, do mm-hmm. drills with people. Because, you know, it's a fundamental truth about crises is with most companies when they have one, right? It is because they're unusual as far as the general population goes, is most times no one involved with the company has dealt with crises before, especially big ones. They don't have the base of personal experience to rely on to deal with it, which means they generally don't know what they're doing, right?
Yeah, correct, correct.
I mean,
as you know, we've got an 800 line and a company crisis website as well. We often get calls through there where literally there has been no preparation and there is no understanding of, well, it's actually not just the, you know, what happens to you, but how you handle it that you'll be judged on, you know. So many boards need to understand that it's just not what happens to you. It's how you actually handle the communications around it as well.
It's at the beginning of engagements, especially with a breaking issue, there's a couple of things that I always do because based on experience. Number one is talking about their base of experience. I think, okay, everybody, this is your first crisis, right? This is maybe my 300th, right? There's nothing that's going to happen here that I and the firm haven't dealt with before to try to calm people, you know, to kind of calm people down. And the other thing is I've got a little deck that I use and thing. One of the slides is what's the reaction of a company if a crisis is handled poorly? And what almost always the first thing I do is they start firing people with the CEO on down.
Yes.
If you remember about in 2019, the big, I don't know if it's got any play in New Zealand, but a big credit bureau, Equifax in the U.S. had a major breach, which is of concern because it's a credit reporting agency, right? And they handled it so poorly. They prioritized it poorly. They kind of came out with the CEO and others and their whole communication strategy was, it's going to be okay. Trust me. We're Equifax. You know, we're Equifax. Mm. Trust us.
Right? Yeah.
This is absolutely right. People don't want somebody telling them it's going to be okay. You got to show them why it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
And within 10 days of that thing break, and they're just abysmal response, the CEO was fired. The chief information officer was fired. A few days after that, the chief operating officer was fired, and the board was just, you know, lining up tin soldiers and flicking them off the table. And that wasn't because of the crisis. That was because of their response to the crisis, or abysmal response to the crisis.
Yeah, you must have seen a lot of different ways that boards have and CEOs have attacked at crisis. What's the worst story that you can tell us?
It happened a long time ago in the mid 90s. So TWA airline, which is a major carrier at the time in the US, in 1996, a 747 took off from New York. TWA 800 got up to a couple thousand feet and it blew up, killing everybody on board.
Oh, nice.
I remember it quite well. It was the first airplane crash that I ever worked on, and I've worked on now 18 major aviation accidents. Yeah. But the CEO at the time of TWA was in London. And so all of this is going on. There's all of this focus in New York. There's a big crowd of family members that have come to the airport, and they're just handling the family members with literally customer service agents, you know. And the TWA CEO decided to go to bed, right? Wake up and take a connecting flight the next day, right? And he arrived and everything had just blown up. It was in turmoil. He was gone within a week.
Yeah.
I remember talking to the head of TWA's communications at the time, who was just apoplectic at his boss.
Yeah.
And the worst thing he did is he came out and said, "Well, I couldn't get a flight." You own an airline.
I know.
Own planes.
I know.
How about you take one out of service, put him on it, and fly it to New York?
That is the issue, David. In our experiences, often crises happen late on a Friday night or on a Sunday morning at 8 a.m. And the systems for many companies just don't work at those odd hours. So you've got to have a plan in place, right?
Well, you do. And that's part of the planning process. And, well, you know, one of the best examples that I can give of that is that we went through some years ago an intensive refresh and replanning at Airbus, looking at everything in North America. You know, how long has this been in place? Is this the way we do it now? What are the technology? We went through that whole process. It was, you know, long, a lot of work. We did some major drills with it. And, you know, about 3 months after we completed the process, there was a major accident. And a guy, John Lauber, who was the head of safety in North America, later the head of safety for all of Airbus, John was in Northern Canada fishing. And when you go into the fishing in this area, you go in by plane. And so where is he? Well, we're not really sure where he is. You know, there's no cell phone, any of this stuff. And it took us 3 days to find John and audit. But it didn't matter because of the plan. A guy named Rudy Canto was the number two, and he was the backup. He stepped into the role as the overall crisis manager, did a brilliant job. As a matter of fact, when we got John back, John did not assume command of the operation. Rudy was doing so well on it, and he became part of the team. That never would have happened without planning and conscious decisions about things. Even things, Dwayne, it's how do you find the people you need if something happens at 3 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah.
Right. A little easier today with cell phones, right? Yeah. But if you have an Apple phone, as I have one, as many people have one, and mine is automatically set to go on silent when I'm asleep, how do you reach me? You just certainly don't reach me from a landline because I don't have
exactly.
How do you reach me?
I mean, we laugh because, you know, there's a lot of talk of balanced life and, you know, making sure that your notifications are silenced and all that, and not achieving burnout. But in the issues and crisis game, that doesn't happen because you sort of have to be on call, right?
Well, on call, but you got to be able to reach people. I mean, there's software to do this, right?
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden, when you've got to put together at 3 o'clock in the morning, you've got to put together a team of 30 people, everybody that's got responsibilities from lawyers to people doing, you know, media monitoring on stuff. How do you do that and actually get those bodies in those seats? You know, where you do it is you have software on phones.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, if they want to wake me up, I got software on my phone. It'll wake me up, my kids, my wife, my dog.
Exactly. Yeah. So you can start a virtual war room wherever you are to go into battle.
Well, you can today, certainly. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. Mm. There's no question about it. And most crisis response now really is. It's not everybody sitting in a room. It's it's gathering on phones and on video video chats, which is just, you know, it's fine. It works well.
And you still meet regularly with the global network PRGN. How's the whole network doing in terms of the Omicron and the virus? And, you know,
It's been interesting. So we've been a member, the Washington DC member of PRGN now for 13 or 14 years. I've served on the executive committee for the last 6 or 7 years. And as a matter of fact, in our meeting next month, I'm the incoming president. I'm going to be president of
PRGN. Congratulations.
Yes, thank you. My staff's not very happy about it, but because as I told them after I got elected, I told them, like, guess what? We are becoming the president.
Because there's a lot of work involved.
But I talk an awful lot with PR agency owners around the globe. I just have a lot of to get to your question of how is everybody doing. It really depends on where they are.
Got it.
I'd say overall people are experiencing after a difficult 2020 when people experienced a lot of economic contraction in their business as corporations got scared, they cut expenses. It was difficult with folks, but kind of came roaring back in 2021. So I think that overall the PR industry across the globe is healthy now, is doing well. In Europe, it's especially Eastern Europe, it's more difficult because of the war in Ukraine.
Yes.
And we had a very difficult issue to deal with. We had one of our members in Moscow, longstanding member of the network in Moscow, and they are no longer in the network now. Not just because they're Russian, but a big part of their business was working with and for the government, and it was not consistent with the values of most of our members. And
exactly,
certainly wish them well, but there just wasn't a place for that in our organization anymore.
Yeah. I mean, history will judge the world on how, you know, everyone is handling the Ukraine crisis. But I mean, words are actually extremely powerful, right? And can be as powerful as, you know, all those tanks running around, right?
It's over the last 25 years, Duane, you and I have both seen and experienced, because we were there when PR met, you're dealing with journalists and it's earned media.
Yeah.
And technology, you know, the buzzword, of course, is disruption. I like to think of it more in terms of evolution, or, you know, you get a wave coming in kind of changing the whole makeup of the beast. But technology has done that more to PR than almost any other industry that's out
there.
Every day, social media, we could get a zillion different things, and you can do it now with the metaverse and blockchain and all of this stuff that's going on. But the culmination of that for this international crisis is that we as a world are experiencing this as we've never really experienced a conflict before, because of technology and because of communication.
I was speaking to somebody who can remember the last war, and, you know, she was saying how you would always hear it was over there, it was somewhere over there, and you wouldn't get to hear much about it. But now it's in everybody's home every single night, so it's almost like everybody feels like they're experiencing it.
And but, you know, even though you know there's a difference between 2014 and the invasion and the annexation of Crimea,
yes.
And here we are, you know, 8 years 8 years later, you know, as a student of history, which is my educational background, you know, the thing that stops and that pops into my mind, and I say this by choice, and this is not a casual comment, making the statement by decision, was Hitler needed to be stopped at Munich. right? Before the invasion of Czechoslovakia, right? Mm. That's what the place where Hitler needed to be stopped, right? Vladimir Putin needed to be stopped at Crimea, right?
Yeah, and, exactly.
But political structures around the world are slow to move. Democracies are particularly slow to move. You know, if you go back to the 90s, it's probably not a person that deals with humanitarian issues or geopolitical issues that doesn't wish you could go back and have a do-over on Rwanda.
Yeah, 600,000
exactly. People were slaughtered.
My last question for you, David, is how do you think PR can positively affect the outcome of the conflict in Ukraine and Russia?
I think that it's overall by fostering communications, right? You were telling me the work that Alexander, the PR has done in New Zealand, helping to push the government to move towards sanctions. Doesn't mean it's a bad government, but as I was saying, democracies sometimes move slower than one would like. But, you know, communications, shining light on problems, just as you've been doing in New Zealand, is a pretty powerful role for PR. We have a Ukrainian employee here at Xenophon from Lviv, and, you know, we're trying to figure out what can we do that's going to be, you know, kind of going to be meaningful. And he's gone and he's recruited a very sharp and wonderfully talented young artist from Ukraine. We have a client called Devio, which is a crypto blockchain company that's launching a new NFT, non-fungible tokens market. Yes. And so she's given us, you know, images of 20 of her paintings, which are just astoundingly good. We're working with Devio or minting, you know, NFTs from that. That's going to be one of the first things that's for sale in their marketplace.
Wonderful.
And of course, 100% of the money goes back to a charity. Although my first thought on this was, listen, I'm a PR guy. You want to get attention on thing. I said, great, let's use the money to buy a tank. My whole staff is like, you can't buy a tank. No, I'm serious. Let's get the money. Let's raise it. Let's buy a tank or two. On things. Now it's going to programs that are feeding people.
But yeah, I think the medicines and all that stuff to help support the families, that's a great thing. Congratulations, David, on having that impact. I think we should probably have another chat at some stage because there's so much that we could talk about, right?
Absolutely.
You've still got to come to New Zealand, and I've got to repay the favor for you taking me around Washington.
Well,
D.C.
I'll be there. I don't know if you recall, but I am a big skier, and this year is my 50th year in a row skiing. And
beautiful.
I've got something special planned at a place in Wyoming called Jackson Hole that I showed my wife a picture of, and she said, "You're not going to do that." And she said, "Oh, yes, I am." But the reason I bring that up is some of the most marvelous skiing in the world is in New Zealand.
Yes.
And I've done, you know, our summer skiing in Chile. But I've always wanted just to go in July to New Zealand and go and try out your mountains because you got mountains.
Yes. You'll probably go to the South Island, right? Because Queenstown.
Yeah. Well, if I'm there, if you're in New Zealand, you're going to go.
Exactly. Well, I think definitely stop by. We'll give you the tour before you go down south.
I'd love to.
Thank you for the chat, David. I appreciate it. And we'll chat again.
My pleasure, Dwayne, anytime. And cheers. Appreciate your friendship and appreciate our chat right now. Take care.
Thank you very much, David. Cheers.
We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Please like, review, or share the podcast with your friends and colleagues. If you'd like to follow us, you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn under Alexander PR, or follow the links in the show notes below. Until next time, thank you for listening.